The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Happy Monday to you. Big news over here in the weekend, an air show tragedy. The death toll is rising from that. That's been on at least the local news quite a lot here in the UK. Also, you probably heard over there or wherever you might be, whether it's in America or around the world, if you're listening to KPCG.FM, but the news of the terrorist attack aboard that high-speed train in France that was foiled by those three Americans. We'll touch on that subject in just a moment. But first here, just a follow-up on Britain reopening its embassy in Tehran. We talked about it on Friday. This embassy that was shut down 4 years ago after a mob trashed the building, trashed the compound. And did you know at the time that the UK government insisted that relations would not normalize between the two unless the Iranians paid full compensation for the damage? But embedded in the reports today, all of the good news about the embassy's opening in Tehran, in London, is the little factoid that Britain paid all the costs for the damage to its embassy in Tehran. Britain paid for everything, backing away from what it insisted in 2011. Yet another concession on the part of the West. This is from The Telegraph today. It says, Britain's vandalized embassy in Iran reopened on Sunday, with graffiti still daubed above the portrait of the Queen saying, "Death to England!" The graffiti's still there. Death to England. A common refrain over there. Death to America. Death to Israel. It says the graffiti, one of numerous slogans sprayed across the embassy in Tehran when it was ransacked by a mob 4 years ago, had not been removed for the grand reopening of the embassy, despite the attendance of VIPs, including the Foreign Secretary, Philip Hammond. Officials claim removing the graffiti without damaging the building's elegant Victorian walls required specialists who had not yet been brought in. But there was surprise that the offending graffiti, which was written in Persian, had not been covered up in any way prior to Mr. Hammond's visit. They couldn't even put a cloth over it, I guess. There were other signs of damage as well, including mirrors that were still broken, Mr. Hammond declared on Sunday. And despite all of this, Mr. Hammond declared on Sunday there should be no limit to what Britain and Iran could achieve together when he reopened the UK embassy in Tehran. No limits on what these two can achieve together. No limits on this new friendship. Of course, that's not what the leaders in Iran are saying. They're talking about all kinds of limits. We needed this deal. We need the sanctions relief. But that certainly doesn't mean we're friends. We certainly don't want any part of American culture, of British culture. They're not going to influence us. Death to America. Death to Britain. The Telegraph says, addressing a largely Iranian audience in the on the embassy lawn, Mr. Hammond said, "We will not always agree, but as confidence and trust grows, there should be no limit over time to what we can achieve together." Very hopeful. Britain's very hopeful about this relationship now, about its future with Iran. It says, Britain has spent hundreds of thousands of pounds repairing the damage caused by Iranian demonstrators almost 4 years ago. Hundreds of thousands. It was no small fix to get the embassy ready. In an interview in this otherwise elegant example of Victorian architecture, Mr. Hammond told the Telegraph why he had not insisted on Iran paying for the damage as a precondition for reopening the embassy. British taxpayers have footed the bill, which runs into several hundred thousand pounds. In my experience, this quotes Mr. Hammond, if you set down preconditions in a situation where you have no dialogue, then you get stasis. In other words, nothing would have happened. Yet that's what they insisted 4 years ago. Mr. Hammond said, we have a number of issues which need to be resolved. The right thing to do is to establish a channel for communication. And so Britain was there to foot the bill, just as the United States is footing the bill for what will surely be a lot of terrorist acts just to try to win Iran over. I mean, if you think about Iran, I mean, they are on the receiving end of all kinds of benefits from the West right now. One handout after another. So much so that they had no part in even paying Britain back for the destruction that it caused just 4 years ago. All of these benefits, and what will the West get in return? What will Britain get in return? What will the United States get in return? Con Coughlin had a piece also in the Telegraph today, writing, Iran's Ayatollahs will never be friends of the UK. He says, here we go again, another British foreign secretary in Iran with a hopeful expectation of forging closer ties with the Ayatollahs. Ever since Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979, the holy grail of British foreign policy has been to reach out to the moderates in Tehran, thereby isolating the hardliners. This has been the holy grail. This has been the policy. We've got to reach out to the so-called moderates. And yet, when you think about when the moderates actually did rise up and do something back in 2009, they were left hung out to dry. That's when the West really had a chance, but did nothing. Coughlin says, so has anything changed in the past decade in this elaborate game of diplomatic cat and mouse? Well, to judge by Iran's actions since the Obama administration's controversial nuclear deal was signed with Tehran earlier in the summer, the omens are hardly encouraging. Hardly. The reason that Philip Hammond finds himself in Tehran today to officiate at the reopening of the British embassy is the expectation that now the long-standing crisis over Iran's nuclear deal has been resolved, there's a genuine prospect of improved relations between Iran and the West. Indeed, never slow to exploit an opportunity to further their interests, the Ayatollahs have recently undertaken a sophisticated charm offensive to persuade people who should know better that a strategic relationship with Tehran would be in Britain's long-term interests. He says, but in this unseemly scramble, the government now appears content to turn a blind eye to some of Iran's more egregious activities. And then he mentions the example of that Iranian mob storming the embassy, trashing the place, splashing graffiti all over the walls. Hundreds of thousands of pounds of damage. Damage the UK government insisted that Iran would have to cover the cost for if ever relations were to be normalized. Well, they backed away from that demand. Later on in Coughlin's piece, it says the Foreign Office also seems to be blithely unaware of the long-term damage closer relations with Tehran might cause to our historic allies in the Gulf region, such as Saudi Arabia, which is currently involved in a bitter war against Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen. For decades, maintaining a close strategic alliance with the Gulf Arab states has underpinned the security of Britain's energy needs. Is the Foreign Office seriously going to abandon that? Finally, Coughlin says, if that is what really lies behind Mr. Hammond's visit to Tehran, then we are heading for a foreign policy disaster of truly catastrophic proportions. For make no mistake, So long as Ayatollahs remain in power, Iran will never be Britain's friend. He's pointed out what several others have noted, the fact that the hardliners are in control, the fact that the hardliners are calling the shots, the fact that the hardliners are the ones that made this deal happen. They're the ones grabbing hold of the money that comes flowing in. They're the ones that get sanctions relief. It's not the nobodies. It's not the commoners. It's not the so-called moderates. Coughlin says, when the U.S. and its allies signed the nuclear deal, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the country's supreme leader, tweeted a picture of President Obama holding a pistol to his head, apparently committing suicide. That is how the Islamic regime thanked Washington for its attempts to forge a new understanding. They got the deal they wanted, and then they sent out a thank you note with the U.S. president pointing a gun to his head. Coughlin says, and there can be no doubt that Britain, too, would be committing suicide if it abandoned its traditional Arab allies in the Gulf in favor of the Islamic fanatics who currently hold sway in Tehran. As long as Ayatollahs are in charge, Iran will be no friend of Britain. That you can be sure of. That you can be sure of. Well, when you think about the significance of Iran coming upon all of this cash, and consider what Bible prophecy says about how World War III is going to start, what will trigger worldwide conflagration. My father talked about this in a Key of David program. This is not from just yesterday's show. I'll talk a little bit more about that one in a second. But this is from last week's program, What is Wrong with Science? And here's what he had to say with respect to the problem with human civilization and the trigger that will cause World War III.
You can see and read Hosea 4 and verse 6, where God says, my people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge, but not material knowledge, not knowledge of this world, but the knowledge of God. They are destroyed because of that wrong knowledge, because they're eating from the wrong tree, and it's leading to physical death and the destruction of all humanity on this earth if Jesus Christ didn't come return and stop it all, which he's going to do very shortly. You can see he's going to have to do it shortly because we're getting close to a time when we can destroy humanity, the human beings, about 10,000 times over already. We have leaders out there that are just absolutely out of control and not thinking with sound minds. And they have nuclear bombs. And especially one nation is really unique in that, and that is Iran. And they're going to be the trigger of World War III, according to Bible prophecy.
Iran's going to be the trigger, he says there. The trigger to World War III, according to Bible prophecy. You can read more about it in Daniel 11 and verse 40 and elsewhere. But how significant is this? With the United States and Britain, biblical Ephraim and Manasseh reaching out, supporting, encouraging, strengthening the biblically prophesied king of the South that will be responsible soon. It will be responsible for triggering World War III. I mentioned last week the prophecy that talks about the ambassadors for peace weeping bitterly when they wake up to what has happened, to what they have done. Can you see why? I mean, you see a leader from Britain in Tehran talking about how there's no limits to this relationship between the UK and Iran. And yet you can look at Iran's actions. Even before the deal was done, back in July, you can look at Iran's actions and see where this is headed. And you can see why the Bible does say those ambassadors, those leaders in the West, and Ephraim and Manasseh in particular, they're going to be weeping when this is all said and done. In the New York Times today, there was a piece titled Future Risks of an Iran Nuclear Deal. Even the New York Times sees this as risky. Something that President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry, they see this as a slam dunk. They see this as an obvious course of action. They can't understand why there'd be any resistance. In fact, they've likened those who resist it in the U.S., in Congress, they've likened those to the hardliners in Iran. But notice what the New York Times said just today in its Monday edition. As President Obama begins his three-week push to win approval of the Iran nuclear deal, he's confronting this political reality. His strongest argument in favor of passage has also become his greatest vulnerability. Mr. Obama has been pressing the case that the sharp limits on how much nuclear fuel Iran can hold, how many centrifuges it can spin, and what kind of technology it can acquire would make it extraordinarily difficult for Iran to race for the bomb over the next 15 years. His program is that most of the significant constraints on Tehran's program lapse after, or most of those restraints lapse after 15 years. And after that, Iran is free to produce uranium on an industrial scale. The chief reservation I have about the agreement is the fact that in 15 years, they have a highly modern and internationally legitimized enrichment capability, said Representative Adam Schiff. He's a California Democrat. He's supporting it now, but he says, boy, that's a bitter pill to swallow. The fact that he thinks it's slowed down for 15 years. But what happens when the 15 years expires? 15 years, as I think Benjamin Netanyahu has said this before, it might be quite a long time in the world of politics. But it's nothing. It's nothing when it comes to world history and nations rising against nations. It says here in this New York Times piece, even some of the most enthusiastic backers of the agreement reached by six world powers with Iran say they fear Mr. Obama has oversold some of the accord's virtues, as he asserts that it would block all pathways to a nuclear weapon. That's the New York Times paraphrasing the president. Well, I think the president's actually used that word specifically, block. All the pathways to a nuclear weapon blocked because of this deal. The Times says a more accurate description is that the agreement is likely to delay Iran's program from a decade and a half. I mean, that's under a best-case scenario, obviously. Just as sanctions and sabotage have slowed Iran in recent years, the administration's case essentially is that the benefits over the next 15 years overwhelmingly justify the long-term risks of what comes after. Well, that's not really a good sign if now even the New York Times is giving a half-hearted endorsement to this deal. Well, I mentioned at the start this terrorist attack that was foiled on that high-speed train in France. There's reports today from the gunman through his lawyer, where he's evidently dumbfounded to have been taken as a terrorist. His only goal was to rob people, he said, because he was so hungry. That's his defense, as he boarded that train with something like, I forget how many clips, 200 rounds of ammunition, machine gun, preparing to, he had been to Syria before, by the way, radicalized, no doubt, with ISIS or whoever. And he was about to gun down a lot of people on that train. And that's when those three Americans, I think a couple of them had military activities in their background. I forget where they were stationed. In any event, rather than focus on that isolated attack, and it's a pretty amazing story, just looking at it individually. But I want to focus on the bigger picture here, again, just going to the New York Times, where it says Europe is facing new uncertainty in terrorism fight. We talked a lot last week about just the surge of migrants, immigrants, flowing into nations like Germany, like France. The Times says 2 days after a young Moroccan man was thwarted from an apparent plan to cause carnage on a Paris-bound express train, European officials confronted the deepening quandary of what additional steps they could take in the face of such attacks on soft targets, short of paralyzing public spaces or even more intrusive surveillance. There's already quite a lot of surveillance all across Europe, in the UK. But if there's one thing about train stations that's different from airports, there's very little security, metal detectors and things like that. You just don't see much of that. It says enhanced security and surveillance measures had already filtered out the young man. He was a 26-year-old Moroccan, but he was one of thousands of Europeans who had come on the radar of authorities as potential threats after traveling to Syria. One of thousands! What about those who travel into Syria and then back? And all the question marks associated with it. This article points out how it's not illegal to go to Syria, but it is if you go there to fight with ISIS. And so how are you going to know? How are you going to keep tabs on all of these people as they return home, as they return to the West, as they plan attacks in France, in Amsterdam, in Germany, in the UK? It says the sheer number of militant suspects combined with a widening field of potential targets have presented European officials with what they concede is a nearly insurmountable surveillance task. The scale of the challenge, security experts fear, may leave the continent entering a new climate of uncertainty, with added risks attached to seemingly mundane endeavors like taking a train. Well, that's one of the best features of taking a train, is the fact that you can purchase your ticket online and show up minutes before its departure and hop on board. The Times says, in fact, the authorities in at least two countries already knew quite a lot about Mr. Kazani, that's the terrorist, before he surged into notoriety on Friday afternoon. He was on a French list as a security threat, and Spanish officials told news media there that he had traveled to Syria, not in itself an offense unless he went there for jihad. It says later, yet with all that the authorities already knew about him, he managed to board unhindered the heavily traveled Amsterdam to Paris high-speed train with a sack of weaponry, probably boarding in Belgium, and was ready to inflict serious damage with dozens of rounds of ammunition, an AK-47, an automatic pistol, and a box cutter. If not for the fortuitous presence of three Americans and the help of a British and a French passenger in the train car, many, many could have died. Pretty amazing story, as I say. A little further down in the piece, again, just to focus in on the big picture here, it says, with determined jihadists, 40 million passengers daily and 100,000 trains, securing Europe's rail networks is a challenge unlikely to be met anytime soon, if ever, according to security experts. See, it's just highlighting how vulnerable Europe is. Here again, what will be the trigger? We've talked about the financial or the economic trigger to bring that core in Europe together, to clear the way for the Daniel 8 man, to lead that prophesied Euro beast. But what about these factors? What about the spread of international terrorism? What about the threat that Iran poses to Europe, to Germany, and other nations in Europe? How do you secure that daily? 40 million passengers, 100,000 trains. It says the problem is that train stations, 3,000 of them in France alone, are open spaces, largely uncontrolled, where non-passengers can mingle freely with those getting on board. You see, it's nothing like an airport. Baggage is checked in only a few places and for a very few trains. Finally, it says here, the half-dozen big train stations in Paris are like villages with a constant stream of unchecked humanity pouring through them every day. Decades old, they were designed with none of today's security problems in mind. They weren't designed with any of today's security problems in mind. Again, just think about this great paradox that we've talked about so often here of late. All of this advancing technology, all of this great progress when it comes to gadgets, when it comes to weapons, and all of this out-of-control evil. It says sporadic patrols by armed soldiers constitute a check, but a very limited one, say the experts. 1 million passengers a day take the French high-speed train alone, and 3 million take the suburban train network. The Times is just pointing out the obvious. How do you secure stations like this with this number of passengers, this volume that you're talking about, this many trains? Well, it's certainly something to watch. This particular attack was foiled. Obviously, it could have been a whole lot worse than it was. But where will the next attack be, and when will it happen? Well, we can be sure that it will happen somewhere, and probably soon. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG, 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma, our headquarters facility there. The live stream makes it available to you, the listener, all over the world, as long as you have internet access. KPCG.fm. Don't forget to send us your feedback, your requests, your input to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Well, I thought I'd use just a few minutes here in the middle segment to update you on some of the facts and figures of this great work that you're a part of, that you're supporting, even if just by listening to this program. This past weekend, the program that played on the Key of David U.S., The Mystery of the Two Trees, I think if you look on the YouTube channel, that's up to around 4,000 views over these past 3 days. And my father also took that subject and used it as the basis for an orientation lecture that he gave to students at Armstrong College a week ago to kick off the new school year. This mystery of the two trees there in the Garden of Eden. I'll touch on that yet again in the third segment here in just a moment. Here in the UK, the program that played this past weekend, Will the Unthinkable Happen? We just had a handful of calls early on with the ring-in Sabbath morning or Saturday morning. So we thought it'd be a fairly low weekend. But as it happens, the calls and the texts and the requests just kept trickling in. We had a pretty good ring-in yesterday morning, Sunday morning. And all totaled, we had 118 people request two booklets. We've had our last chance, that short book about General MacArthur's statement back at the end of World War II. And then also The Wonderful World Tomorrow, Mr. Armstrong's classic work from many years ago, which in that book, if you haven't read it in a while, there is a stark contrast between those first couple of chapters and then what's discussed in the later portion of the book. As Mr. Armstrong compares this world, today's world, the present evil world, with the world to come, with the wonderful world tomorrow. So as I say, 118 requests came in for those two booklets. That makes this past weekend's program the seventh highest response that we've gotten this year. Just to update you on last week, the numbers were comparable. I think we were at 117 or 18 after the weekend last week as well, but counting that trickled in over the week, the one on Rule Your Own Spirit with the offer of How to Be an Overcomer, that all totaled has brought in 124 requests. So both, and that's the sixth highest yet. So both of them very similar in terms of overall response. This next week, by the way, I just want to update you on this because this is a very exciting development. As you know, we've been in hot pursuit of our 2000 goal for sending out Mystery of the Ages in response to the Key of David UK here in the UK. The book, or rather the program we've put together for this coming weekend, is titled The Most Important Book Since the Bible. And we really do draw a lot of attention, not only to Mystery of the Ages and the contents, but even what led up to its production in 1985, and then some of the classic statements made by Mr. Armstrong about that book, about that textbook, and about his intention to distribute it to the largest audience possible. We're at about 40% of the way to our goal, 784. Our hope is that the program that plays this week will really be one of the stronger responses we've gotten to this point, so that we can push to that halfway point and hopefully see that end goal, 2,000 copies of the book being distributed by the end of this calendar year. Hopefully see it within striking distance. On radio, last week's, at least judging by SoundCloud, the most popular program that we produced for the Trumpet Daily last week was the one we posted on Monday, the Doomsday Clock counting down for the global economy. As of this morning, there were 512 replays or plays on SoundCloud. And of course, there's quite a few other areas or ways that people can listen in as well, including live, either locally or on the, locally in Edmond, I mean, or on the live stream. But as far as SoundCloud goes, that appears to have been our most listened to broadcast from last week, last Monday's program on the Doomsday Clock. The second highest, according to SoundCloud, was the one we posted Tuesday, titled Systematic Rape as Theology. That had nearly 500 plays as well. You can go over to the YouTube channels. I mentioned the Key of David U.S., my father's program, and how that the most recent program on the Mystery of the Two Trees has generated about 4,000 views. The one we played here in the U.K. that was also posted on YouTube, I believe, on Friday, it has up over 2,000 views. The one on Will the Unthinkable Happen Again? Right now on TuneIn, the app that goes on your phone or on your device, we've got 433 followers, so we're slowing down as far as attracting new followers there. Hopefully we'll rev that up as the year wears on so that we can hopefully get up over 1,000 followers before too long. So that's it for the news or the stats or the figures for God's work this past week. We'll try to update you further either next Monday or sometime next week. For those of you that are interested in our listening audience, the amount of literature going out, the impact that this great work is having on those who follow. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Once again, this is KPCG 101.3. And we'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily.
In my doctrines class for Herbert W. Armstrong College, this morning we handed out an article by Herbert Armstrong written back in 1978. That class, by the way, doctrines, we opened that up for people to take it online this year. And we've got, I think, all total 350 people listening in to that class three times a week. And one of their handouts, as I say, this article from 1978, where Mr. Armstrong, toward the end of his life, he died in 1986. But this is after quite a few years in the work with families that had had children, and then those children were having children, those that had grown up in the church, the Worldwide Church of God. And he prefaced this article about the foundation and the history of the Worldwide Church of God by saying that we're now in the second, almost third generation of the church. Many, if not most, plain truth readers today know little or nothing about its origin, history, source, and nature of its government. The purpose of the article was to give that history, to help young people in the church to understand their history, to know their foundation, to know their heritage. And to know that, you've got to go back to the beginning. And that's what my father did on that program, too. This past weekend, the mystery of the two trees. And then again at orientation last week. And he mentioned at that orientation before the students at Armstrong College that Adam and Eve, there in the Garden of Eden, here they were, new. I mean, they were created as adults, not little infants. But they had minds that were empty. They didn't have any knowledge. They had adult minds, but minds that weren't filled with knowledge as yet. But that's what the two trees in that garden represented, knowledge. And in the tree of life, God offered man the essential knowledge to fulfill his awesome purpose. In this message, the mystery of the two trees, well, you're really getting at what God wants to establish or to teach first of all. I mean, this is true education, and to say it, the two trees, it sounds so simple. It's easy to doze off with a message such as that. Many people did in the Worldwide Church of God. Mr. Armstrong, for those last 10 years of his ministry, that's what he was concentrating on, primarily. A message about the two trees. How important it is. How foundational it is to true education. And all of it happened, or is discussed, right there in the first two chapters of the Holy Bible. Of course, the subject of the tree of life is, it really runs right through the Bible. If you understand God's purpose, if you understand the truth of God, if you know the basics of God's doctrine, God's teachings, that history of the two trees, it runs like a thread all the way through the Bible. And you find references to it, in fact, the tree of life, in the book of Revelation, from beginning to end. Mr. Armstrong used to talk so often about going back to the beginning so that we can understand the world we live in, so that we can understand why the world is the way it is today. Genesis 1 starts out by saying, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth." It doesn't say he made everything 6,000 years ago. That isn't true. But it does say that he created the heaven and the earth. We know it's established right from the start that God is creator. We know that the universe had a beginning. that it had a creator that made it. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. There was a beginning point for this material creation. Now, during the Middle Ages, theologians would read this and assume that it meant the earth, the universe, along with Adam, that it was brought into existence 6,000 years ago. And once that idea was exposed as a myth, it really went a long way toward discrediting the entire biblical text. But all that this shows is how ignorant so many people are when it comes to understanding the truth of the Bible. If you actually examine what the Bible says, then you learn early on that there's a time lapse between the first two verses in Genesis 1. A sizable one at that. Between these two verses, there are tremendously important events that happened that are discussed in other parts of the Bible. Let me show you in Isaiah 45 and verse 18, Isaiah chapter 45. It says here, the first part of verse 18, it says, "For thus says the Lord that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it, he has established it." Notice the word heavens there first. Plural, meaning universe, not just the earth. But here again, God made it. God created it. There's a verse in Hebrews 11 that says, "Through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that things which are seen are not made of things which do appear." It was all made from something invisible. There was a time when God used his power, when he used invisible spirit energy to bring right into existence matter, something that didn't exist before. Verse 18, it says, the last part, "He created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is none else." The Hebrew word for "in vain" there is tohu. And it can mean waste or empty, chaotic. Now, if you turn back to Genesis 1 and verse 2, well, we can just start in verse 1 again. It says, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth." And then verse 2 says, "And the earth was without form and void." The earth was without form. That, too, is the Hebrew word tohu. So, to go back to Isaiah 45:18, it says there that God created it not in tohu. He didn't create it that way. But verse 2 of Genesis 1 says, "And the earth was," and the meaning there is "became." You can look at that Hebrew word on your own time. "And the earth became without tohu." It became without form and void. The same Hebrew word there. Something happened, in other words. Something happened. Let me read to you what Mr. Armstrong wrote in The Incredible Human Potential. This is page 53. "What God does, or rather what he creates, he maintains. What he creates with for a purpose. He intends it to be put to use. A right use that preserves and improves. This use, maintenance, and improvement is controlled in the process of united cooperative action by the government of God." God is creator. What God creates, he creates for a purpose. He intends it to be used, his creation, to be preserved and improved. That's God's great plan. That's God's great purpose. So we know how he made it originally. And we also know, based on Isaiah 45:18 and now Genesis 1, verse 2, considering what that word was means and considering the words form and void come from the Hebrew tohu and bohu. It became waste and empty. What happened? How did it become that way? Well, it became without form and void. As it reads there in the Hebrew, tohu and bohu, it became that way because of Lucifer's rebellion. His rebellion against God's family government. Well, family was a secondary plan, plan B. That's what God enacted once the angels rebelled. But the God kingdom was certainly like a family. Lucifer, like God's created son. But he rebelled against God, his creator. And so the creation, that material creation, he was presiding over earth. It turned to chaos and decay. Deterioration set in. Back to IHP, it says God is creator. God is also ruler over his creation. He preserves what he creates by his government. What God creates, he creates for a purpose, to be used, preserved, and maintained. And this use is regulated by God's government. When the angels rebelled against God's government, the preservation of the physical earth and all its original beauty and glory ceased. The physical destruction to the surface of the earth resulted. God is creator, preserver, and ruler. Satan is destroyer. That's the significance of these few verses that so few people understand. Genesis 1, 1 and 2, Isaiah 45 and verse 18. You could add to that what's revealed in John 1, verses 1 through 3. Or to read more and study more about Lucifer's rebellion, Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28. How come you don't hear more about this in the world of traditional Christianity? This is the foundation. I mean, this can seem, as my father brought out last week, so basic. So much so. I mean, people in the Worldwide Church of God heard it over and over and over and over. It put some of them to sleep, perhaps a lot of them. And yet, this is the most essential knowledge that God gave to Adam and Eve, this history, this foundational history, even what led up to here, the two trees, which we'll have to get into more at a later time since we're out of time here. Send us your feedback if you like, or any of the booklets that we've offered today or that you might have heard in a promo. TD@kpcg.fm will send out a hard copy of those books right away if you're interested. Or you can just go to thetrumpet.com to download your copy of any of these works right now, today. All of our literature is offered free of charge, without cost or obligation to you. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial at our headquarters campus in Edmond, Oklahoma. And it's heard all around the world through the internet at kpcg.fm. As always, we want to thank you for joining us today for another edition, another program, and we'll look forward to seeing you again tomorrow.